UFP, the United Federation of Podcasts.
Welcome to Franchise Fatigue, the little podcast on the United Federation of Podcast Network, where your hosts go through movies, remakes, and sequels, and discuss them for you. My name is Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, coming up very soon, he's meeting me at the train station. I'm just on the train right now, and my co-host Zach is just, he said he was going to meet me at the train, but he had something he had to do ahead of time. Sounded a little weird to me, but I'll meet him there. Oh, here he is, pulling up right now. Zach Moore.
It was the kids. They called me Mr. Glass.
Mr. Glass. That's an interesting nickname. That sounds like a bad guy nickname.
Oh, really? I thought it was a heroic nickname.
Heroic. Well, he's, you know, everybody's the hero of their own story.
Indeed.
Indeed. So, anyways, we are here and we're discussing some train trilogy, which I can't remember the name of.
The East Rail 177 Trilogy.
The right. East Rail 177 Trilogy. Something different for us, and something that's basically new for me. I saw Unbreakable many, many, many moons ago after I'd finally seen The Sixth Sense. And I watched Unbreakable, and I'm like, yeah, this movie's really good. And then I didn't like the twist ending.
You did not... Okay, jumping ahead all the way to the end. We're already joking about it in our introduction. But you didn't like the ending where Samuel Jackson was the villain?
We'll talk about that later.
Okay. All right. Very good. So
we'll hold on to that nugget.
This is a very unique franchise, very unique trilogy.
It is.
Because you had a film that came out in 2000, which is Unbreakable, which is what we're talking about this time. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, before Glass, I guess before the trailers for Glass came out, I should say, revealing that Split was part of this franchise was a spoiler. Right, because that was a huge deal, and obviously we'll talk about that next time we talk about Split, but you got three movies here that came out, you know, Unbreakable came out in 2000, Split came out in 2016, and then Glass came out in 2019. Mm-hmm. So you have a movie, and then 15 years.
A loose sequel or something, which I haven't seen, so yeah, I haven't seen the other two. I haven't seen Glass, and I haven't seen Split yet. That's new to me.
So this is some unique takes from Brandon coming in here. But, yeah. I mean, you're at least familiar with how these are all connected on some degree.
Some degree. Like, I get that Samuel Jackson is in, like, an insane asylum in part three or whatever. But, honestly, I really know nothing about the other two. James McAvoy has multiple personalities is all I know about the second one. And I really don't even know the plot of the third. So I am going into these blind. Have I seen the trailers? Yes, but honestly, I don't remember them. So.
Excellent. So yeah, it's new for us. It's new for you. And then, again, this is so unique because this is a very refreshing, unique way to go about making a franchise or a trilogy. It's not like this is not based off any pre-existing material. It's not even, they didn't even plan out like, okay, we're going to make this one, and then this one, and this one. This is a movie, and there were some other leftover ideas from it, and then years later, Shyamalan revisited these. M. Night Shyamalan, the writer, director, creative mind behind this series, and then made Split, which was, for all intents and purposes, standalone, and then Glass ties them all together. So we'll unravel how all these are connected as we discuss here. But man, this is, I can't think of another franchise that is like this, honestly. So it's very cool to tackle something like this on Franchise Fatigue.
Yeah, I couldn't think of anything that would be like this either, where something gets tied in later. Like, there's nothing that I can think of on like, I guess the only thing close would be maybe Prometheus, because it's such a loose prequel to Alien. Like, it's a very, very loose prequel. And then Alien Covenant is the one that really bridges the gap between Prometheus and Alien. You know, so, but that's not even the same thing. So, yeah. So I'm looking forward to checking these other two out. I like Shyamalan as a director. Like I think everything I've seen by him, I enjoy. I haven't seen all of his movies, but like, I like The Village. I like The Lady in the Water. I absolutely, and I know I'm the only one. I freaking love The Happening. I think The Happening is a freaking masterpiece. I love it. Mark Wahlberg's not the best actor, but I really, really love that movie a lot, and I will champion that. And then, you know, I've never seen anything of the animated Last Airbenders, but me and my kids watched the movie, and I'm like, this is a pretty good movie. Amazing. And I know that that just got completely trash-talked, but I went into it blind, not knowing anything about it, and I'm like, this is a pretty good movie. And I'm like, now I'm disappointed there aren't three more movies.
Well, the thing about Shyamalan is I respect him as a filmmaker. I think he has a very unique, distinct style. And also, I mean, he is... The thing is, when he first came on the scene with The Sixth Sense, it came out of nowhere. He blew people away, right? Unbreakable followed it up. And like, oh, that's great, too. Signs after that, which I think if I had to say what my personal favorite Shyamalan movie was, it would be Signs.
When we're watching that video, man, and that alien pops out, man, scares the crap out of me. It scares the crap out of me. That is like... The scariest moment in cinema history is when that alien pops out of that home video.
Well, and the thing about all his movies, right, they're original, other than Last Airbender, right, which is based off an animated series. All of his movies come out of, like, an original idea. You know, he's the creative force behind him, so you got to respect him, you know, hit or miss, right? But the thing with him was he was 3 for 3. The Village came out. The Village was very back and forth. I really didn't like the back and forth twists and turns of that movie. And then I believe Lady in the Water was next, and I was kind of lukewarm about Shyamalan after that, and I heard it wasn't good, so I didn't see that. I heard The Happening was terrible. I didn't see that.
Have you never seen The Happening?
I've never seen The Happening either, no.
Most people hate it, man. I love it. I think it's fantastic.
I've seen many a meme about The Happening and jokes and whatnot. But then, he's like, okay, he had a couple misses on his own, like, creative... from him, because he's like writer, producer, director, right? He's the whole creative team is him, and that's why people were comparing him to a guy like Hitchcock, was like a creative force, right? And you know, then he does Airbender, and then he does I believe it's After Earth with Will Smith, Will Smith's son. That just looked terrible on it, by all accounts it was. So all that happened, and then he kind of got back down to basics, and he did a horror movie called The Visit, which I haven't seen, but people gave it a lot of critical acclaim, and he got connected with Blumhouse. Right, okay. which is they're making
the
new Halloween movies. Blumhouse is one of my favorite studios working today because they take high concepts, they have reasonable budgets, and they churn out a lot of movies. Some are hits, some are miss, but the hits are so successful that carries on to the next cycle. They do it all again. Mm-hmm. So great movies like Get Out and Us by Jordan Peele come from Blumhouse partnerships. So
Halloween,
Halloween exactly. Mm-hmm. So Shyamalan got connected with them. And then I heard a lot of stuff about The Visit, and then, Split came out, and they're like, look, Shyamalan's back, you gotta see it. And then I went and saw it, and now I'm back on the Shyamalan train. But that's my history with M. Night Shyamalan. But I think I don't put him up there with the Chris Nolan right now because he's all over the place with quality.
Up and down, yeah.
Right. But I think, there are very, very few directors still working today where you say they directed this, and their name is their brand. Right? Chris Nolan's name is his brand. David Fincher's name is his brand. And Night Shyamalan's name is his brand. So in a world where everything is increasingly cookie cutter, right, and you know what to expect, I still find it comforting to know that there are filmmakers like this out there. So that's my overall flyover of M. Night Shyamalan. So.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, I haven't seen, I think if Last Airbender, we just saw it like a year, maybe a year and a half ago. And so like that's the newest Shyamalan film I've seen. I'm pretty sure. So I'm looking forward to Split. I'm looking forward to Glass. I'd like to check this out. I'm glad you were open to this. This was my idea. And because I watched Unbreakable. I had it on my DVD shelf, and I'm like, I'm going to watch Unbreakable tonight. And I felt exactly the same as I did the first time I saw it. So, I don't hate this movie, but we'll get into discussions on it shortly here. Awesome. So do you want to... Give us a little bit of the runaway train. That's a bad comparison. Trivia.
It's a science experiment. Tying together our last franchise, Back to the Future. So, Unbreakable. Writer or director in Night Shyamalan, he always envisioned Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson for the roles of David Dunn and Elijah Price. He wrote them with them in mind. They have been partnered in previous films like Pulp Fiction and Die Hard with a Vengeance, so they've had some on-screen history and chemistry together.
So oh man, I forgot about that.
Yeah, this is them reuniting again for the big screen. Now Audrey Dunn, who was played by Robin Wright Penn at the time, who most people would know today from House of Cards, but mm-hmm. I will always think of her as the Princess Bride. Yeah. So, well, what a career she's had, right? Wonder Woman. I mean, she's all over the place. She trained Wonder Woman and those films. Brandon, I know you don't watch a lot of comic book movies, but so you know, she does appear in Wonder Woman.
She's in like, Blade Runner 2049.
She is in Blade Runner 2049. Oh, it's what an amazing filmography. but anyway, Julianne Moore, she turned down this film to be in Hannibal, the 2001 sequel to Silence of the Lambs. So
that's a good movie, but it's got some interesting things to it.
Yeah. That's why Jodie Foster did not appear in Hannibal. But that's maybe well. Obviously, we'll have to do that franchise sometime.
Yeah,
Brandon. But
Hannibal Rising is like one of the only movies I've shut off and didn't finish. I'm like, F this.
Wow. When Brandon can't finish a movie, guys, you just heard how much he loves all these other questionable Night Shyamalan movies. He can't take that one. I've never seen it, but let's put that one on. Put that one in the queue. We'll tackle the Hannibal movies down the road.
I know we'll definitely get John Mills on to do Manhunter.
Very good, very good. So Charlene Woodard, who plays Samuel Jackson's mom in this film, she's actually 5 years younger than him, but she plays his mom as the child, and they age her up for the final scene mm-hmm. of the movie. And she appears in Glass, by the way. Mm-hmm. Same actress. So a lot of actor continuity in this trilogy, which I think is great as well. Speaking of... actors and directors. M. Night Shyamalan does his Hitchcockian cameo. That's another reason people are comparing him to the new Hitchcock. Like, there were literally magazines with him on the cover, and it was like, the new Hitchcock? This is how highly touted this guy was in the early 2000s. But he makes a cameo.
Yeah, I'll just answer that question right now, and I'm just going to say no.
Are you not going to start a podcast on M. Night Shyamalan's movies with your friends?
No. Is M. Night Shyamalan the new Hitchcock? No.
Well... In a Hitchcockian move, he has a cameo in all of his films, and in this film, he plays the drug dealer at the stadium that David mm-hmm. Dunn pulls over and doesn't catch, but that's mm-hmm. him. And
I saw that.
He also appears in the next two movies, but you'll find out soon enough. So, the disease that Elijah has, osteogenesis imperfecta, is real, but it's extremely rare. And there is an Australian celebrity and reality TV show personality, Quentin Kinahan. And they were born with that disease. So that's not something they just made up for the film. It does exist in the real world. Now, the cane that Elijah has is made out of glass. And that was Samuel Jackson's idea to keep leaning into the glass metaphor visually and otherwise for his character. A lot of his scenes... or through glass, and that's intentional. Mm-hmm. Like, you see the reflection of him in a TV, things of that nature. So, also, complete aside, it's a really cool interior of that car he has. It's all padded.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that must be a really comfortable car to ride in, I think. So,
The purple color, I think, was his idea too, wasn't it?
He's all about purple. Purple's his favorite color, so that's kind of the color scheme of his character. That is why Mace Windu is the only Jedi in Star Wars to have a purple lightsaber.
Yeah, purple lightsaber.
The story goes like Sam Jackson, he asked George Lucas, like, hey, can I have a purple lightsaber? He's like, no, lightsabers are green, blue, or red. You can't have a purple one. So all that to say, when he had the purple lightsaber, it was a surprise to Sam Jackson that they let him have it, and he was very pleased. So.
I heard he would threaten to walk off the film if he didn't get a purple lightsaber.
I don't think it came to that, Brendan.
Well, I don't know. We'll have to ask John Mills about that. John Mills knows his Star Wars.
I think they should have just had more color lightsabers. Like, I wanted to have yellow lightsabers and purple lightsabers, right? I mean, why only have three colors? But anyway. Now, the first act of the script for Unbreakable, the original script, is what M. Night Shyamalan took and extrapolated out into this film. Because he felt the other two-thirds didn't have enough connective tissue to the first. So, to compare him to another filmmaker we just referenced, George Lucas, he kind of took those out, put them aside, and focus on the first third of his original script. Now, that has become kind of legendary to a point where it was like, oh, he had a whole trilogy plan for Unbreakable, right? And not per se, he had ideas, right? And these ideas are what he revisits with the next two films and extrapolates from there. But it's not like it's not like George Lucas where you're like, oh, I have three parts of Star Wars and I cut the first third and I saved the two. That's not like that at all. But he did have ideas here. To that point, as you'll, you know, this is a minor spoiler for you, Brandon, but in the scene where David Dunn is in the stadium, he's trying to brush past people to get, you know, impressions, right? When he first starts to get impressions of the crimes they've committed or the secrets they're keeping, he brushes past a mother and a child, and he senses child abuse. And in retrospect, that can be seen as the Kevin Crumb character from the next two films. And it's been said that Shyamalan had that character in mind to put in this film, and that's why I mentioned it when I talk about the second two-thirds of this original story that he had written. So the pieces are there, so you can retroactively say that was Kevin Crumb that day and his mom at the stadium. So now there are a few deleted scenes that can be found on the DVD or home video release of Unbreakable. One is Audrey and Joseph sitting in the hospital waiting for information if David survived or not. Another is David taking a shower after he gets home, but he's seeing the news footage of the wreck and he starts to cry because the reality of what happened starts to hit him. Another deleted scene is Elijah at age 7. He goes to the fair and he gets in one of these carnival rides. It's like a spinning ride, and he puts stuffed animals around him to kind of cushion him from being hitting the sides, but they slip and then he starts to hit the sides and he breaks all these bones. This horrific scene. They take this scene actually and they put it in glass. They use it as a flashback, which I think is great. It's so cool that they take these deleted scenes and use them in glass.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
Yeah. And there's another scene. They actually do the same thing. It's a scene where David goes to check on Joseph to make sure that he's sleeping okay. And they kind of share a father-son moment there. And that's another scene they take, which wasn't in Unbreakable, but it was filmed. And they use it in glass as a flashback to kind of reinforce the relationship between David and his son.
So they're saving budget on glass by using footage that was already shot.
I thought it was great because you have the actors and they don't have to do all this crazy CGI stuff, right? It's like, no, that was actually filmed for Unbreakable. That was so cool. I thought it was really clever. And just a couple other scenes. David actually, he goes to a priest to kind of he's trying to wrap his head around his survival, and the priest tells him that, look, it was just luck, and he had a nephew that died on that train. He was looking for answers. He isn't going to find him here. So I thought it was an interesting commentary on, you know, luck versus a greater purpose, which is one of the themes of this movie. There's also a scene where Audrey and David, they go on their do-over first date. And I'm not sure exactly how this would have played out because I haven't watched these deleted scenes in forever, but on my notes here, there is a friend of Audrey's that comes up to them and asks what kind of lawyer he is, which implies that she was having an affair, which I think is kind of left in the movie. Yeah. We can talk about that. There's a moment in the movie where it's like, And then finally, there's a couple other scenes where Elijah's taken away by other doctors after he has his conversation with Audrey about David. And finally, David goes into the locker room of the stadium, right, to lift even more weights, and he lifts up to 500 pounds. He starts bench pressing 500 pounds, and then he gets up, he sees the entire football team is watching him in awe that he's that strong. So those are some deleted scenes. You can find them on your home video releases of Unbreakable. Final bit of trivia here. The early previews of the movie did not have the superimposed text on the ending. Like, David Dunn reported Elijah to authorities, you know, where it's like almost like a based on a true story. And that version was released in France and other markets, but the text was included in the TV home video versions of the film. And then finally, on a budget of $75 million, Unbreakable cost almost three times as much than both Split and Glass combined.
Wow.
And it had a worldwide gross of $248 million. So there you have it. There's your Unbreakable trivia, Brandon.
Awesome. Good job. That nearly broke me, but it was some good stuff.
I see what you did there.
So when was the first time that you saw this?
I saw it in 2000 in the theaters.
Did you?
Yeah.
Had you seen Sixth Sense by this point?
Yes, I had.
When did Sixth Sense come out?
Sixth Sense was 1999.
Because I remember it was quite a while after Sixth Sense came out that I saw it, like a couple of years, and I had gone like that whole time without any spoilers, because everybody's like, there's a twist ending, there's a twist ending. And then like 10 minutes before the end, when I'm watching it on my first watch, my uncle turns to me and he's like, So he's, you know how Bruce Willis hasn't been talking to anybody except the kid the whole movie? And I'm like, for crying out loud, like there's 10 minutes of the movie and I didn't see that ending coming. So I was very upset, but whatever. So yeah, I went a long time without seeing, knowing what the ending was on that. But that's my little story for that one. So let's just jump into the problem that I had first off. So okay. I watched this movie and I really like this movie and I think this movie is really great. And I didn't like the twist ending because I didn't feel like the twist ending is necessary for the movie. And upon my rewatch, I haven't seen it. So whatever it was 15 years ago that I saw this for the first time, I'm still watching this and I'm still thinking that this twist ending is not necessary for the movie that I'm watching, because the movie to me is about Bruce Willis's character. And yes, Sam Jackson's character is there the whole time, but it's just, to me, it just felt tacked on because he's like, oh, because I had a twist ending at the end of Sixth Sense, now I have to be the guy that does the twist endings. That's what it felt like to me then. That's still what it feels like to me now.
Ooh, I hear this one has a surprise ending.
Yeah.
They even have that line in there.
Yeah.
When right Elijah's at the beginning. Mom gives him the comic book, right? Well, okay, I disagree. I feel like them being arch nemesis is part of the hero's journey in this movie. Right? I mean, that's part of what Elijah is all about. He's all about the comic book mythology. He's like, some of them are friends like us, right? He's so caught up in this. And he's obviously obsessed, right? And his obsession to find the opposite of himself, I totally buy that he would have done all these terrorist activities and disasters, caused all these disasters to kind of flush out, if you will, someone who's truly unbreakable, the opposite of Mr. Glass.
It felt weird to me because this guy is just a security guard at a stadium. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, like maybe it would have felt better to me if he had been a police officer investigating these crimes or whatever the whole time. I don't know.
Well, that's immaterial. That shows you, like, he's like, why did you go into security? Right. And because he wants to protect people. Now, this is his origin story, right? This is Bruce Willis's origin story. So yeah, he starts out as a security guard at a stadium, but then who knows what the future is going to hold for him, right?
Right.
That's what you got to remember. Like, and I remember when I first saw this, I think I was a little disappointed in it because I was like, oh no, that's really what I was expecting, and it felt like, well, I thought I was going to see Bruce Willis be a hero, and you know, but again, this is the chapter one of his story, you know. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I didn't need him to see him going around, and that's part of it, right? He doesn't need to already be a cop or something. He needs to just be like, he's in security, but it's just something he does. But it's in his DNA to do it. And I think that's the point that Elijah's making when he's talking to him. Like, why didn't you open a chain of restaurants? You know, why didn't you go into security? So I saw no problem with that. And again, that shows the how they are on both sides of the spectrum, because David, who is selfless, right? Elijah is very selfish because ultimately his quest is selfish because he wants to be proven right. That's what his ultimate concern is. And he doesn't care how many people have to die in order for him to be proven right about his theory about how comics are mythology and there's people on the other ends of the spectrum. So I think that's all really baked into the story. Like, if without that, then it really is just a random accident that he survived and that he hooked up with Samuel Jackson and he set him on this path of herodom, and that's it. I mean, to me, that would feel kind of surface level. You know, I would feel underwhelming if that was all there was to it.
We've talked about before, I'm not big into comics. I've read a few, I like a few superhero movies. I don't really know much about comics. I guess, like, how common is it that the nemesis is the instigator for the hero? The nemesis brings the hero about. Because in this movie, Mr. Glass is the reason that Bruce Willis becomes a superhero, because Bruce Willis is just going through his life not realizing that anything is wrong. You know, nothing is happening. So the reason why I said it would have made better sense if it was a cop investigating is because he could have done something where he was aware of weird events going on in his life. Like, maybe at one point he had to lift a car off of somebody, realizing he has crazy strength in certain situations, and he's going through his life not realizing this. But it's almost like, what this movie is, it's not like almost what it's like. What this movie is the only reason he becomes a superhero is because Mr. Glass, he targets him, And he keeps pushing him and keeps pushing him and says, yes, you are, and yes, you are. Keeps casting this doubt on him. I believe that had Mr. Glass not come in, Bruce Willis.
David Dunn.
Very
comic book name with the alliteration, yes.
Right. Would have gone through his life and nothing spectacular would have ever happened again in his life. That's what I think would have happened.
Well, true. So, but that's every hero's journey. What if, the stormtroopers didn't come looking for the droids and kill Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru in Star Wars? Luke Skywalker never would have gone off and met a Jedi, right? So, I mean,
that's different. That's not Darth Vader going out of his way to convince Luke Skywalker he's a Jedi.
But there's nothing. But what is wrong with the fact that the villain created the hero here?
I don't know. That's the problem that I have with the story.
There's nothing wrong with it. I think that just shows you that often villains end up creating their heroes through their own plans. But the thing about Mr. Glass was he wanted to find this. Like, his mission in life was to find the opposite of himself, and that was his mission. He found him, right? And that's the thing. Like, to your point about him being a cop or something, the fact that Bruce Willis was just a normal guy in obscurity going about his days, that's what makes it so interesting, because it's somebody who gets plucked out of obscurity and gets set on the path for greatness, right? That's a hero's journey. So, I mean, it's not common for, like, villains to create the heroes, so to say, on the regular basis. But, I mean, it is common for them to have some kind of personal connection. You have, like, Magneto and Professor X in the X-Men movies, or Lex Luthor and Superman in some iterations, like in Smallville. They're best friends in the high school days. So they're taking a lot of tropes from comics, and they're mixing them all up and repackaging them. And that's what makes this a fresh approach, though, because this is the early 2000s. This is when this is like post-Batman and Robin, right, which kind of blew up. When we talked about the Blade trilogy, right, that was the beginning of, like, comics being taken seriously again on the big screen. X-Men and Spider-Man will come next in the early 2000s, right? But people want to get away from capes and tights and all these sort of tropes, right? So a movie like this is perfect for that time, because it's talking about all these tropes, but it's trying to look at the superhero story through a real world lens, which is a very unique approach. And it's not based off anything either. It's not, hey, man, we have a cool new interpretation of Superman. It's like, no. This is its own universe from page one, and I respect it for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then I'll put to you that what I know about superheroes, and then this is going to lead into why it feels weird for me.
Okay.
So Spider-Man gets bit by a spider. That's how he gets his powers, and then he starts playing with the powers. And he figures out how to squirt and whatnot, and then squirt his vent. I don't know. You know what I'm trying to say? His webs. Okay. So in Batman 1989, Joker kills his parents, which I understand is not what happens in the comics. I understand that. Okay. But even there, while he inadvertently sets him on that path, that's it. He's not affecting his life anymore. And like Bruce Wayne makes the choice that he's like, okay, he makes the choice, because my parents got killed, I'm going to do this. And then the movie ends up that he ends up facing that villain at the end. What's the other one that I'm thinking of? I guess X-Men. So Wolverine was, like, tested on, and then he decided to use the talents that he had, and he was trained by the side of good, right? So, like, all the ones that I know, this is the weird one. So,
well, why does that matter?
That's all. I don't know. It just... I don't know why it matters so much, but that's my hang up on this film.
And so you didn't see this twist coming.
I didn't see the twist coming because I was just caught up in David Dunn's story. Mm-hmm. But when the twist came in Sixth Sense, I'm like, that's a very what's the word I'm looking for here? That's a very cathartic twist. Mm-hmm. Like, that movie earned that twist. And this one just felt like a twist for the sake of being a twist. And I realize I'm really in the minority on this opinion. Mm-hmm. And then when we get, I'm sure that when we get to my final ratings, I will still surprise you. Okay. But it's just that. And then, like, the on-screen, this guy went to jail, and this is what happened. Like it's a true story.
That was bizarre. I didn't understand that. I didn't understand why they did that. It's like a TV. It's like the end of a Law and Order episode. Something. I just don't understand why they did that. And that doesn't hurt the movie at all for me. It felt very out of place in the movie they just told. It almost made it feel like, because that's what you see in Based on a True Story.
Right.
Now you see the freeze frame, and you see, like, you know, David Dunn went on to start his own. Right?
Yeah.
Elijah is currently serving a 25-year sentence. And so That is weird, but no, I find it refreshing, and I didn't see this twist coming, and I didn't really know what to make of it when I first saw it. I enjoy this movie more every time I see it, because I see like the layers that they're going on here with, and also like you know talking about we talk a lot about you know Mr. Glass being the villain of the twist and all that, and we can still talk about that more at the end if you want, but I want to talk about David Dunsum, Bruce Willis. You know, Bruce Willis is a guy. You know, he phones in a lot of performances, I think, right? Mm-hmm. But when he finds the right role, I think it really fits him. I think this is the right role for him, just kind of like a worn down guy who's just going through life. And I think it was a very bold move to have the quote-unquote hero, I guess, well, he is the hero of this story. Like, the opening scene, we have him you know, take off his wedding ring and try to hit on somebody on a train. Like, this shows you this really isn't the best guy, right? He's not your Dudley Do-Right Superman type, right? He's just a normal guy, does some shady stuff, trying to hit on somebody on a train. You're like, oh, man, that's... And the scene is played appropriately awkward as well by all involved. So,
yeah.
And that sets the whole tone for who this guy is to a certain degree. And he kind of... Not that he has to have, like, a redemption arc from that, but he goes from being that kind of guy to the guy who's going to go seek out crimes and stop them. So that is his hero's journey. And then, you know, rekindling the relationship with his wife and then also his son. You know, so there's some good human stuff in here. And that's why it's cool to take this everyman, you know, blue-collar worker like David Dunn is, you know, security guard at a college stadium. And
or like
into
Tom Cruise in War of the Worlds.
That's Tom Cruise.
Okay, and see, now that scene, I think it kind of alleviates some of the pain on a rewatch because, you know the trouble that he's going through. Like he's on his way out of that marriage when he's on that train, right? And, like, upon a rewatch, you see it where, yeah, they end up together at the end, but he's on his way out and he's holding on and it feels like his wife is not holding on. And so he's like, you know what? Maybe I don't have to hold on anymore. So, like, the first time you see it, it has one layer. And then seeing it again, it has a different layer.
Well, and then he immediately puts the wedding ring back on when that woman's like, I'm going to go find a different seat, right? And you're right. But let's talk about that scene with him and her when she's like, I'm going to ask you something, and it's not going to affect me, no matter what you say. And she says it like three times. She's like, it doesn't matter what your answer is. It's totally cool. It's totally fine. Like, she goes way out of her way to say, it's totally cool, tell me, whatever. It's like, have you been with anyone else since we've been having problems? He's like, no, I haven't. And then she, like, breaks down. She's like, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So clearly she has been the one who has been unfaithful during this period, this rocky period of the relationship, which I thought was another interesting layer to have. That's what I took from that.
I didn't take that from that scene.
What did you take from that scene?
I just took it from the scene where she was saying she wanted to know. And those were tears of joy because it really was important to her. She was telling him it wasn't important, but it really was important because she wanted him to tell the truth. Right? So I didn't take it that she had been cheating on him.
Maybe it's because of the deleted scene where it's like one of her friends mistakes this guy for a different guy. That kind of colored my opinion of it. But you're right. Yeah. Contextually in the movie, I can see you can read it a lot of ways, but I like that. So I don't know. That's how I read it.
Even in the deleted scene, she didn't necessarily cheat. Okay.
Right.
Because that could have just been somebody she met and became infatuated with and was talking to her coworker friend about him. Oh, I really like this guy, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't get the impression that the wife cheated.
Okay.
In this movie.
I think it is open for interpretation.
No, you're wrong.
But no, that's. Having this guy, like, because like you said, he's on the way out. When he gets home, we find out that he got a job offer from New York, and he's like, I don't know if I got the job. I probably didn't, but either way, I'm still moving there. And then he goes upstairs to stay in his son's room. So you, like, man, this guy's life is like, and this is like real life. Like, I appreciate the real life struggles of the characters in this movie. You know, because you have your superhero drama, obviously, and then you have your real life drama. You know. And and speaking of drama, what about the scene where the kid's going to shoot him? Man, that's an intense scene.
Oh, man.
Right?
Yeah. That scene is very intense. And that kid is very confused because, you know, his dad is like, he thinks his dad's a superhero. And you know what? He probably would kill his dad if he shot him, right? No matter how strong his dad is, that would probably kill him. So, yeah, that's a very, very strong, powerful scene. And I like his reaction where, instead, he just gets mad at his son and is like, "You're grounded," and like,
right.
or like he's whatever.
Like, I am your
says,
father. Like, you're going to listen to me. He's like, "If you shoot me, you're right. It's going to bounce right off me. But I'm going to get on that train. I'm going to go to New York, and I'm never coming back." Right? And like, he has to kind of use psychology on the kid to make him stop. Right? And that was a very, very intense, very powerful scene. I think.
Yeah.
I like the relationship with him and his son here. Like, especially the scene where he's lifting weights, like in the basement, and he's like, "Wow, how much you put on
there?
Don't
you ever try this." He says, "Don't you ever be this stupid."
Well, then I like how the son, he keeps getting further away. Like, he's like, "I want you to stand back." Like, he's standing kind of far away, and then he's in the doorway, and he's like up the stairs, you know? And then they end up putting like paint on each side of it just to see how strong he is, and he can, you know, press about 350 pounds. So,
okay, so I wanted to ask you about that scene too, because it's like, why does it seem like it's hard for him to do this? When they're putting hundreds of pounds extra every time, right? Like, why do these weights seem heavy for him to lift?
Well, he's not Superman, right? It still takes exertion, but he can do it. And also, it's one of these kind of fight or flight reflexes you have. Like, obviously, you know, we had the flashback with him and his wife in the car accident, right? From college.
Yeah.
He rips off the door of the car and gets her out of there. You know, and he's not hurt at all. So when he's in these extreme circumstances and he has to do these things, he can. They're not easy, but he can do them. But of course, as someone who thinks he's a normal person, he's not going to put himself in those situations on a regular basis. So I just see that as like somebody finding their limits, you know, because this is not, again, this is a real world version of comic books. So he just can't effortlessly lift 500 pounds, but if he really tries, he can do it. And that's why he can do it.
So he's only invisible when people don't look at him.
To me, okay, let's talk about this.
Do you know what that's a reference from?
Is that Mystery Men?
Yes, Mystery Men, yes.
You thought you got me, didn't you? So let's use the Twilight Zone rule, the Buck Halton rule, as they say, for Twilight Zone, right? Where you can't have two things. Like, you can't have time travel and aliens, for example, right? Our friend Tom from the Twilight Zone podcast talks about this a lot. Buck Halton was a producer on the Twilight Zone, and one of the rules was we can only have one fantastical, mystical element per story, right? So let's apply this to David Dunn. Right, where he is super strong.
So he's got two.
Yeah, he's unbreakable.
And he can psychically sense people.
So that's, I think that's one of the things when I first saw it, I was like, well, that's weird. Why does he have both of those, right? That those seem to have no connection between them, right? So what do you think about him having the two powers that have nothing to do with each other?
Like, so the unbreakable and the strength go hand in hand.
Well, yeah, no, I agree. Like, it's invulnerability, strength, fine. That's one package.
Yeah.
I get it. But, like, the psychic ability, like, the intuition, because he has an intuition when he first meets Samuel Jackson. Like, he has feelings, but then he starts really, Samuel Jackson's like, "Have you ever tried to focus it?" And David Dunn starts thinking about it, and then he starts, you know, standing in crowds and having people brush by him. He gets these flashes of, like, crimes or secrets. It's some dark stuff. I applaud the movie for, like, going there, right? Because it's like, God, people are terrible, right? For the most part, they do terrible things. So we see a lot of dark stuff here. The child abuse, which we can infer is the character from the next two films, and then some other dark stuff. But what's your take on that? Did that strike you as odd that he had this other ability?
It does strike me as odd. And it's one of the things that, like, okay, this is really weird that he has this. Because it doesn't seem like it's related to the others, as you've said. It doesn't. It's not a strength thing, you know. Like Superman, he's like an all-encompassing hero. But I give it to him for that because, you know, he's the first. He's really the first major superhero. He can fly. He has strength. He can blow cold air. He can do laser beams out of his eyes. Right? Like, Superman can do everything because he's Superman.
Well, also,
right?
Okay, that's your outside of the universe explanation. The in-universe explanation is Superman, he's an alien, right? So his physiology is totally different. So the yellow sun is what gives him all his power. So, like, his sight, all his senses are extenuated. He has other abilities and all other, like, that all tracks inside, like, there's a logical explanation. But for Mr. Glass, he's like, hey, I have very breakable bones. I know someone else out there is on the opposite end of the spectrum, and they have unbreakable bones. I'm like, okay, fine. But what is the psychic part coming in?
Yeah, exactly. So what does Glass have? See, I get it. Superman's a Mary Sue.
All right, well, we'll talk about
I'm
that
kidding.
Off microphone. No, but, no.
So if he's got psychic abilities, what does Mr. Glass have that's the opposite?
Well, we can get into that in the third film, Brad, and I'm not going to spoil anything for you. But
that's fine.
It's not an AB, though, but they do add more to Mr. Glass's supervillainy repertoire in the third film, which, to be fair, is not a retcon, I think. I think you can see how you can extrapolate that from what happens in this film. But anyway, you'll get there when you get to Glass. But
all that I want when we get to the third one is more great one-liners like Schwarzenegger had in Batman and Robin. What killed the dinosaur? The Ice Age!
Batman and Robin is the fourth film of the Batman franchise, just for the record. So.
I know. Did I say three?
No, but it's the third film of this franchise. It doesn't.
I know. Batman. I know that's the fourth one.
Chill out, cool buddy!
Chill out.
So,
this is better than Batman and Robin.
We have found some common ground in this conversation. But the thing with the psychic ability, though, that gives him the knowledge to stop a crime, and then his strength and unbreakable ability gives him the means to stop the crime. All right. So how else would he find out about this stuff? He would have to be a cop, like you said, or have a police scanner or things like that. So it is kind of a shortcut, but then so many other heroes like Superman, like even in the film, right? Elijah tells David, he's like, well, you know, other heroes have X-ray vision, and these are extrapolations of things, maybe just a feeling, maybe an intuition. So again, outside and inside the film itself, like it's looking at comic books through a real world lens. So that is their explanation for it. I guess I'll go with it. But like even in the, you know, in Split, in the next film, there's a whole set of rules and stuff about that character. And those makes it like nothing contradicts it. Nothing is. I just think that's a more that package goes together makes more sense than the package of Bruce Willis's powers here. I mean, that's
we'll get to that next time because don't spoil anything because I haven't seen it yet.
Right. So there you go. So that is one thing. I think even back when I saw it, I was like, well, that's weird. Why would he have that power? But without that power, what is the story? Right. Where does he go from there if he doesn't have and he doesn't find out about Elijah at the end? Right, because he's like, I think this is the part where we shake hands, and that's because he knows he'll discover all that stuff. Then, which I don't know why he decided to do that either. I guess he was so obsessed about proving his point about how you're Superman and I'm Lex Luthor, basically.
Yeah,
he was so obsessed with that that he just had to make it a reality. But this guy, he is mentally disturbed, right, Elijah? I mean, that's the thing about him, right? As we were joking about at the beginning, every villain is the hero of their own story, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he does some horrible things here. But he's doing it, you know, to prove a point. And what's sad is everyone in the real world will think he's crazy, but he's not. He's actually right.
Mm-hmm.
But the way he goes about trying to prove that he's right is horrible. And that's the difference between a hero and a villain. So,
right. You know, I like a lot about his character, Mr. Glass, because, you know, like that opening scene when he's born, right? That flashback to when he's born. Like, that's a traumatic thing where that guy's like, were you abused or something like this? Because this kid's bones are all broken.
Did you drop this baby? They're like, no, of course not.
Yeah, did you drop this baby? Yeah. And the fact that she gave birth in like a clothing store, you know, like just like it was a really interesting, you know, backstory for his character as well. And I like him as a character. And I'm sure, I don't know, you've read a lot of comics and you didn't see that ending coming, you know, so I don't know if most people didn't see that ending coming. I don't know. But yeah.
Well, and then, you know, and I had forgotten, because I hadn't watched this in years, but I'd forgotten they do frame it, like, for Mr. Glass, right? I mean, like, it starts out with his birth, right? We have a flashback to him as a kid. We're going to have more than one flashback with him as a kid, but they end up editing those out. And, you know that having those flashbacks about him, like, informs his character. And it's almost 30 minutes into the movie before you even meet adult Mr. Glass. Right? Samuel Jackson. So there's like a buildup because you know you're going to, I mean, obviously, if you've seen the trailer, you know Samuel Jackson's in the movie, right? But I like that first scene. It tells you a lot about his character, too, when he's like, he's going off about how this comic book artwork, it's artwork, it's true art, right? And he's going to sell it to this guy. And he's like, all right, pack it up. Yeah, my son's going to love this. And he's like, your son? He's like, hold your son, 4. He's like, okay. Leave. We've had a misunderstanding. This is not for, you know, some 4-year-old's wall. This is art. And that tells you a lot about his character, and I like that.
Yeah, yeah, I love it. I think Samuel Jackson was a good choice for this character. You know, if that's who Shyamalan wanted from the beginning, then I mean he's spot on, right? He wrote this character for him, and I think he did a great job for it. So,
well, let me ask you about David Dunn's weakness, the water. As it's what's revealed in the film, as a kid, mm-hmm. he almost drowned, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, do you think the water is a mental block for him because that is how he almost died as a kid, or is it truly his kryptonite?
No, jeez, I don't care. I just interpreted that it's his kryptonite, I guess. I don't know, but I mean, like, he showers, right? So, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, all right, fine. I thought it could be just a mental block, right? Because, you know, he had a traumatic experience as a kid, right? And just because you have unbreakable bones and strong muscle doesn't mean you can breathe underwater. So yes. I think it might be, and that's something they explore in Glass, actually. Not spoiling anything. Okay. They explore if that's a mental thing or if it's a real thing. So mm-hmm. that's again, you can look back to the first film and see, oh, okay, there's some ambiguity there. So anyway,
yeah,
I'll just we'll, so you've we'll plant seen all that three, for now. Hey? I've seen all three, so I'm all in the theaters.
Yeah.
So
okay, yeah, that's funny.
This is my favorite trilogy of all time, Brandon.
Oh dear Lord, goodness. Okay, well, anyways, is it really?
No, Back to the Future. Everybody knows that.
Oh yeah, yeah. You told me that last time.
It's literally the last episode of this podcast.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. That's great. Okay, well, I don't know. I don't have much more to add to this. Okay. Was there anything else you want to talk about?
No, I do have a question for you, Brandon.
Ooh, what kind of question do you have for me?
How many times is East Rail 177 either said or seen in the film?
Zero, because I don't remember it at all. Well, seen or said. Okay, so, I don't know. We saw it on the news. Do you count the sticky note on the fridge?
You tell me.
You tell me. No, this is yours.
Yes, yeah. If you've seen or said, I don't care what format it's in.
Okay.
If you see East Rail 177, East Rail, or just 177 by itself, there's multiple instances. That is how this franchise got its name. So that is the tally board that we are looking at when we cover this franchise.
Five.
Okay. It's actually nine.
Okay.
I was shocked it appeared as much. I thought I was going to just mentally, like, okay, that time, I had to go get my phone and, like, keep track because it kept popping up so much. So let me tell you where you see it real quick. We hear it on the announcement of the train at the beginning of the film. Bruce Willis is riding the train. We see it on the TV with the news report of the crash train. Interestingly directed scene there where the kid's watching TV upside down. I just thought that was little flourishes of direction by Shyamalan there. Third is the post-it note on the refrigerator that you mentioned, Dad's train. Fourth is at the church where they have the funeral service for the passengers of East Rail 177. Fifth is in the newspaper because we see it in the newspaper article. Sixth is on the radio. We hear it on the radio that Samuel Jackson is listening to in his car. Seventh is at the physical therapy. He mentions it to Bruce Willis's wife, Audrey, when David Dunn goes to look at the train wreckage. There's a keep out sign, East Rail, right there. And then finally we see it in the flashback when we're seeing how Samuel Jackson, Mr. Glass, set up all these catastrophes. We see the 177 on the train there when he gets off the train. And the guy's like, passengers aren't allowed in there. And they just let him walk off. So who knows what he did to the train there. So those are the nine times you see or hear East Rail 177 in Unbreakable.
Nine. That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. So that's why it's called the East Rail 177 trilogy, Brandon.
Okay. So do they say it in the other movies?
Have to watch and find out.
I will have to watch and find out. Excellent. Okay. Well, let me ask you this question then, Zach. How would you rate this film?
I would give this 4.5 out of 5 glass canes.
Glass canes. And that last one was the one that fell and shattered?
Yes, the last half of it shattered.
Oh man, so, that was painful when he fell down those stairs.
And this is one thing that I didn't want to touch on. This is an explanation for our rating here. I can say this. Like I wish there was more of a physical kind of confrontation for him at the end for David Dunn. Like I know he fell into the pool and he saves that family and the kids save him and that's great. But It's interesting also that the villain he's fighting is like a guy in a like repairman suit, and he's wearing a, you know, like a security guard poncho. I think the iconography there is really cool. Like, look, if you translate superhero costumes into this and villain costumes. But, you know, at the end when David Dunn's talking to Elijah's mom, he's like, oh, well, there's the strong man villain, and there's the mastermind behind the scenes, right? Like the two layers of villains, and they mention that, and that leads into the twist, right? That is one thing I was disappointed in. Like, oh, he just kind of beat up some guy and choked him out and won, right? There was no, like, real physical. Like, he had to overcome the water, but the kids helped him. So, I don't know. You have a guy who's unbreakable. I wanted a real physical match for him, but guess what, Brandon? We're going to get that in Glass, and I'll leave it there. So, 4.5 out of 5 for me.
Okay. So, based on my discussion, what do you think I'm going to rate this thing?
Well, you don't do halves anymore.
I don't do halves anymore.
Based off your discussion, 3?
3. So I give this 4 canes.
Okay, 4 glass canes. All right.
Yeah. So I'm liking this movie, and honestly, right up until the last scene, I would give this 5. I really love the pacing of this movie. I really love the direction of it. You know, Shyamalan took a little bit of flourishes sometimes with the camera that were a little too much. Like that scene where the comic is upside down, and then he turns it and turns the camera so it stays upside down, and then the camera keeps turning. I'm like, chill out, dude. Like, what are you doing?
Refusing to show you at the proper perspective.
Calm down, Shyamalan, and leave the camera steady. Like, that's a little bit too much. But whatever, he's fooling around. He's the next Hitchcock. And, you know, so, okay, let's go with that. Except for the ending. The ending is what gets me. I'm like, I don't need this guy to be the villain. I was content with the story we had, and I don't know. Like, for me, that just doesn't work, and I understand that I'm so much in the minority on that. But, yeah, 4 out of 5. I still really enjoy the movie.
Brandon, you're missing a huge opportunity. You have an Alfred Hitchcock podcast called Good Evening, right?
Yes.
Logically, the net follow-up podcast would be a M. Night Shyamalan podcast called Good Night.
Oh,
it makes perfect
Bravo.
Sense.
Bravo, man. Bravo.
I'm so proud of myself right now. All right. Well, final question, as we always ask on Franchise Fatigue. Brandon, is this franchise fatigued?
Absolutely. I don't want to see another movie in this franchise. This doesn't need to be a franchise. I don't need this guy to be a villain. Absolutely. This is a one and done.
One and David Dunn. I'm on fire tonight, guys. Jeez. But
is your girlfriend pregnant? Are you going to be a dad? Are you practicing your dad jokes?
So that's a good point. There doesn't need to be another movie of this, but because I think this is an origin story, right? We saw this hero's origin story, David Dunn, and there are lots of obstacles out there he hasn't encountered yet, right? I want to see him fight someone who can be a physical match for him, right? Mm-hmm. And so, no, I'm going to say this franchise is not fatigued because there's had they not put those silly texts at the end? Like, that's another reason this is not a 5-star film. This would be 5 if not for, like, David Dunn called the authorities. And, like, what are you talking about, Shyamalan? So I'm going to say no because I think there was talk, you know, as I said in the trivia, there was talk about, like, an Unbreakable trilogy back in the day. But, you know, Shyamalan wanted to do new projects every time. And he's like, well, maybe we'll get back to this. And eventually, you know, we did. And that's what we're here talking about, this franchise.
Right.
But I think there are enough kind of things out there. There's a lot, you're just starting on this hero's journey with this character.
Right.
So I'm going to say no. I'm going to say if they came out with an Unbreakable 2, I would absolutely go see it in the theaters, even if I didn't know it was Unbreakable 2. And that's exactly what happened.
So that words on the end, like, is that, do we know that was Shyamalan that put that there? Like, maybe the producers or the studio said you got to put something there?
Oh, I didn't see anything about, like, studio interference. It was just something they decided to do.
Because you said they didn't release it like that in France or whatever.
Yeah, because on the initial early screenings of this, it wasn't on there either. I think it just added a certain sense of finality, right? Because they wanted to, like, if you just have him walking off, right? You're like, well, what happens? Like, does he call the cops? Or does he just know that he's a supervillain and doesn't say anything about it, right? But I think there's plenty of deleted scenes that we get on the home video. There's no extra scenes at the end where, like, the cops come arrest Mr. Glass. So in order to give some sense of finality to this and not just Bruce Willis walking off and then ending the movie, they wanted to say, yes, he called the cops, and now he's in a mental institution. And we'll pick it up 19 years later.
Okay, look, like, okay, so I'm going to add this here, and maybe this means that you're editing this podcast because you're going to fix this crap here. But, like, so he's going to, Bruce Willis is, like, this strong man. Like, what, he punches Sam Jackson once, and the guy's, like, dead because he's, like, the guy's Glass.
Well, first of all, watch Glass. All these, see, had you seen all these movies before we talk about this, all these things would be answered for you.
Fine,
and then also, I do want to say probably the scariest, most effective scene in the whole movie to that point is when Mr. Glass is chasing after the guy with the gun behind him, the gun in his jacket, in his pants,
yep,
and the camo jacket. And he sees the stairs, and there's like the zoom out. You see the stairs, and he's rushing. And you're like, oh god, I know what's gonna happen. Like you physically, like at least me, I like physically like recoil because I know it's gonna be terrible. And when he falls, it's like, oh my god, it's awful. But yes, that's why they're the perfect yin and yang, Brandon, of good and evil.
Perfection. So. This is the greatest thing since Batman and the Joker. I love it.
There we go. You got it on tape.
Zach, where can people find you when you're not trying to kill a bunch of people to find out that I'm your Canadian yang?
Well, Brandon, you can find me personally on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreOnCCH. I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Holding a Smallville, where you talk about that young Superman show. You can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. And Brandon, we're not running around in a poncho. Where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me on Trek FM with a show called The Line, which is all about Star Trek Picard. Over on the Fandom Podcast Network, my friends Chris and Tom and myself, we have a show called Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, where we cover all of the one and only Hitchcock's filmography. And coming up soon on the Nerd Party Network, John Mills and I and our friend Tristan Riddell are going to be covering David Fincher's work. We're going to be covering all his films in chronological order leading up to the release of Mank, which is his new Netflix film. Well, that's all we've got for you this week. Thank you so much to the executive producers of our network, Ken Tripp and Tony Robinson. Thank you for making everything work behind the scenes. Thank you so much to Zach Tripp for our wonderful theme music. All you listeners out there, if you like what we do and want to throw us a couple of bucks, we'd appreciate it on Patreon. $3 a month, you can get early releases of episodes. $5 a month, you get a monthly commentary by Zach and myself on a Star Trek episode. And $10 a month, we will do a little roundtable episode with you. Ratings and reviews is another great way that you can support us, so please give us a rating and review. We did get a new one recently. Thank you so much. I don't have the name of the person in front of me, but we did just get one. Yes, at some point we will cover Children of the Corn. For that person. We did see that review. Well, that's all we got for you this time. Until next time, I don't know how to leave this out because I don't know what's coming.
It was the kids. They called me Mr. Glass.
This has been a production of MTMR Media Works.